The next case on for oral, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Court of Appeals for a second argument today on our Zoom calendar, October 18, 2023. The next matter on for oral argument is Minnesota Board of Pharmacy versus Northland Vapor and others. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep an audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Cook. I'm appearing in place of Tyler Leverington. I represent the Northland Vapor appellants. The central question in this appeal is whether the district court can alter the plain language of its own order after a party complied with that order. We've raised multiple independent reasons.
Can I stop you for just a moment? Just so I can understand what's going on in the big picture here, there were, as I understand it, there were products that were removed even before the disputed order and the timing of the order. Am I correct that the only products at issue in the appeal are the products that were removed after that order?
That's correct. So there have been products since the time we filed this appeal that have actually been destroyed, that right. were embargoed under the statute. The products subject to this appeal were the ones that were removed after the order expired.
Got it. Thank you.
I plan to focus today on two of the issues that we raised. First, that the court could not correct its order as a clerical mistake. And second, that the court lacked jurisdiction to order the return of the products. This case was commenced by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy after the board claimed to have embargoed Northland's edible cannabinoid products at a warehouse in Moorhead. The embargo statute at issue in this case is Minnesota Statute 158.38. That statute sets out a multi-step process for embargoing products. The first step in the statute is for the board to find probable cause to believe a drug is adulterated or misbranded. If the board makes that finding, it is then required to physically mark the products that are suspected of being adulterated, and that imposes the embargo on the products. After that, the board must file a petition with the district court within 30 days for an order of condemnation. That hands the matter over to the district court, which makes its own determination as to whether the products are adulterated. And then finally, there's an appropriate remedy that's to be imposed if the court makes that finding, whether it be destruction, rebranding, relabeling, or something of that nature, depending on the nature of the violation. The problem in this case arose right from the start of that process because the board did not follow the plain language of the embargo statute. The board sporadically placed labels on certain boxes in the facility, but then it claimed to have embargoed other boxes that were not labeled. Northland raised this issue immediately in its answer, as it pointed out that only certain products had been embargoed, and we proceeded to file multiple briefs over the course of a few months that briefed this issue on the embargo statute.
When you say this issue, are you referring to the timing of between the labeling and the petitioning?
I'm referring to the fact that the board had not physically marked the boxes for embargo. They had only marked certain boxes, not all of them. They provided a verbal notice to an employee, and the board's position was that verbal notice and the placing of a few labels on some boxes, some shelves, was sufficient to essentially embargo everything.
Well, you agree that the district court ruled in your client's favor on that issue. And do you agree that that issue is not challenged on appeal by cross motion, cross appeal?
Absolutely. And I did want to emphasize that point, because I think the board's brief at certain points, it refers to its attempted embargo as though it's synonymous with an embargo. And at one point, I think the board even argues that the district court's order had no effect on the validity of its embargo. And so that's not correct when we look at what the district court actually ruled in terms of the statutory interpretation and that embargo being deficient. There were a series of orders that were issued. The May 2nd order was the temporary restraining order that prevented Northland from removing products until the court ruled on this statutory interpretation issue.
And you're not, if I read your brief, Your client is not challenging that order in this appeal either, correct?
That's correct. So the May 24th order set this deadline for expiring that removal prohibition. And that's really what kicks off what we're appealing here, because effectively what we're asking is to give effect to the plain language of the May 24th order. The May 24th order, again, it confirmed Northland's view that the products were not embargoed. The court agreed with us on statutory interpretation, but then it extended that restriction a little bit further. It said that Northland could not remove products until midnight on May 25th, 2023. Northland complied with that order. After that, about a week later, the board came back with a motion for contempt because the board had went out to the facility after that May 25th midnight deadline. At that time, certain boxes had been removed from the facility, and so the board claimed that Northland was in contempt. So the matter was teed up on May 31st, and that's what we're appealing is that order, because the court at that time stated it made a mistake when it stated that the board had until midnight on May 25th, because the court had actually intended to give the board until the end of that day to go out and re-embargo these products. So the court did not hold Northland in contempt as the board had requested, but sua sponte, it did order Northland to return the products that had been removed after May 25th at midnight, which were no longer in the state. So that the court ordered those products to be returned so the board could go out and re-embargo those products. We filed this appeal. That May 31st order was reduced to writing on June 2nd. So there's two related orders that form the basis of our appeal, but they essentially are the same thing.
Put some facts around that May 24th order. The court issued that around 1:50 in the afternoon, is my understanding. And my understanding is then the department or the board says, hey, we're coming tomorrow. And so your client had at least some notice that the board is coming the next day. But then midnight hits and they start moving all the stuff out of the warehouse. So, I mean, it seems a little unseemly, and it seems like everybody was on notice that the board's coming the next day to go try to fix what they didn't do right the first time.
I think that's an accurate recap of what had happened. The order was issued around that time. I don't recall. I believe it was after 5 o'clock when the board sent that email about coming out the next day. There was no request on confirming what the midnight deadline meant or anything of that nature. I believe the board simply said, we're coming out to the facility to the next day. They were allowed access the next day. But by that time, the order had expired. And the products were removed from the facility at that point. And I think the issue really boils down to the board is suggesting that Northland was somehow required to alert them to a different interpretation of the plain language of the order. And I don't think there's any requirement. I think the order says what it says in terms of the midnight deadline. I don't think it's up to Northland to correct the board's misunderstanding of what had occurred there in terms of that deadline that was in place.
When you say correct the misunderstanding, would you agree that we have an ambiguous term that's used in midnight?
I do not agree with that. I think it's unambiguous with what midnight means. I think it's a singular time on each day. Midnight on May 25th means a single time of the day. And we've cited cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court that confirm that midnight.
I understand that. I'm just talking about in common vernacular. If you and I were having a conversation and you said, how late are you going to be out tonight? And I said, I'm going to be out tonight until midnight. You wouldn't say, wait a minute. You have to go through a time machine in order to do that because midnight already occurred for this date. I mean, we use the term midnight both to refer to the end of the day and the beginning of the day. I'm not saying you necessarily lose on your argument, but wouldn't you at least concede that the term is ambiguous?
I don't disagree within that context. Certainly that's a fair point that in the common vernacular, if you're talking about that type of instance, that gets used in that context. But I do think it means something legally that is significant. I would point to, for example, Rule 14.03C of the Minnesota General Rules of Practice. That defines when you have to file a document electronically, and it specifically says by 11:59 p.m. you have to file it to be filed on a day. Otherwise, it's considered to be filed on the next day. So I don't disagree with you in terms of common language that's used, but I think legally speaking, and that's really what we have to look at, is what is how is this interpreted?
That rule doesn't use the word midnight. It just refers to 11:59 p.m., knowing that 12 a.m. would be the next day, would not be on that same date. I don't know that that necessarily, I don't know if that's a slam dunk in your favor.
Well, I guess my point is by getting that specific on 11:59 has to be filed. If we were to file something at midnight, the court could reject that if it was due on that day to say that was not filed on this day. And so we're simply asking that that term be applied consistently to the court's own deadline that it's establishing. And I would further, I think the district court agreed with us on this point because it said it made a mistake. I think by definition, the only way the court could have made a mistake by saying midnight is if that definition is read the way we are reading it, because the alternative is if it could be read either way, there would be no reason for the court to have to go and correct its order or say it made a mistake in ordering that.
So counsel, just a moment. It seems to me the district court could have said it made a mistake even by agreeing with what Judge Rasta said. I inadvertently included an ambiguous term in the order, but I want to actually ask you a legal question and I just want to make sure I understand your argument. So you seem to be suggesting that the district court didn't have the authority to modify or amend the TRO to explain what was meant by midnight. Is that your position?
That is correct, because...
And it's because of the Rule 60 provision on clerical errors? Because I guess what I'm concerned about, you know, Minnesota Rules of Procedure allow injunctions to be modified even on appeal. I mean, it is, a district court retains a lot of authority to modify an injunction order. And I am referring to the rules. Are you familiar with that? I guess I'm just struggling with why the district court would lose authority to modify the TRO.
I think a couple points to clarify with that. I think, first of all, I don't believe Rule 60.01 differentiates between different orders. It applies to orders or judgments, so I think it does apply. And that's, the court did not elaborate on the authority. That's the closest authority that I can arrive at that would maybe permit that. And that's why we've addressed that issue. But to your question, I think the more important point to highlight is there was no temporary restraining order in effect after it expired. So the May 2nd order was a temporary restraining order. The May 24th order expired the TRO. And so my position is, I understand the point that a court may have some more leeway in terms of modifying a pending restraining order that's in place, but this was no longer in place after it expired. It expired at that deadline. And so
what authority do you rely on for that? I mean, the expiration date is certainly a term of the TRO. I don't know that that means that a district court has lost authority to modify the TRO. And I'm sorry if I'm asking something that just seems so obvious to you, but if you wouldn't mind explaining it, I'd appreciate it. And then I'll let you go on.
But my position is when the court expires its own TRO, there's no TRO in place. And so we would be back to square one, essentially. If the board wants another TRO, it should have to follow the regular motion practice for requesting that, setting up a hearing and so forth, and going through that process. Because we're at the same spot, legally speaking. There's no separation between an expired TRO and not having a TRO in the first place. And so that's the point I'm trying to hit at is... It's not a temporary restraining order that's still in place. It's expired. It's gone. So we're dealing with a situation where nothing is in place at that point. And I think that's confirmed by the court's own ruling that the products could be removed at that point. So I don't think that there was that restriction that's in place. And the other point I want to highlight here is the court stated it intended to give the board another day to embargo these products. That may be true, but I don't think it changes the fact of how we read this legally, that the May 24th order says what it says. I think court orders should be read by the plain language of the order, not based on some secret intent that's not reflected on the face of the order. And that's confirmed in the case law that we've cited here on clerical errors when it talks about, for example, the Wilson versus City of Fergus Falls case, where you have an unambiguous order and the judge is amending that order with something that's discretionary. The court in that case said that's a judicial error. It's not a clerical error because you're coming to a different disposition than what was previously ordered. The same is true here on all of that. We have a complete unambiguous order, and it's a discretionary issue. Whether the order expires at midnight or another day is discretionary. And as a result, it's a judicial error, not a clerical error. And that's why the court could not correct it. I will yield my time. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Hans Anderson. I represent the respondents, the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and the Minnesota Department of Health. The orders appealed were proper, necessary, and should be affirmed. The district court made no errors of law, had jurisdiction, and properly exercised its discretion. Simply put, respondents had statutory authority to embargo the non-compliant products at issue, and the court had statutory authority to condemn and destroy them. As such, the court had jurisdiction to maintain these products as it deemed necessary during the pendency of the matter. That is all the court was doing in ordering them to be returned, maintaining the property at issue.
When you say, hold on a second. I just want to make sure I understand what's at play here. Do you agree that the court's order is not currently, the court's order in defining what's necessary for a notice and marking for an embargo is not at issue on appeal? The state has not challenged that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
So here's what's troubling me with the state's position and with what the district court did, and you can disabuse me of my concern. So the district court has this order in place. You can't move the products from the property until a certain date and time. The court then issues an order indicating the expiration of that that restraint. The district court, I've read the transcript. The district court says, "Oh, it was my mistake. This is what I intended to do. I intended to do something other than what I did," is the way I interpret what the district court's saying. That the district court acknowledged that the midnight reference was at least ambiguous, and maybe if not ambiguous, certainly referred to a date other than the date the district court intended. So if that's so, and the Northland had authority then, because there was no longer a restraint, to move the products out of state, and the district court refers to those products as, quote, unembargoed at that time, what is the authority of the district court to order unembargoed property products that are outside the state back into the state in order for the board to have then authority to over those now Minnesota products? What's the source of that authority?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The source of that authority is the injunction that the court had issued. The court had issued an injunction prohibiting appellants from removing any product whatsoever from the facility until it could rule on the statutory interpretation.
Right, but the district court, let's assume for the sake of argument that that order expired, and that's the term the district court used, expired. So once it's expired, let me just take that off the table. Let's assume for the sake of this question that that Northland had the authority, had the right, had the permission to remove products from the state of Minnesota.
Certainly. So, yes.
What authority does the district court have in ordering a company to return, again, what the district court's language is, unembargoed products to the state of Minnesota so the board can then start to embargo those products? What's the authority to do that?
Sure. So within that hypothetical, let's say that the appellants had authority to remove them outside of the state of Minnesota. At that point, I do not believe, and I'm not arguing, that the district court nor the respondents would have had authority to embargo them if they were properly outside of the state of Minnesota. The issue here, however, is that there was an injunction prohibiting them from removing any product.
Just so I understand what I believe is a concession if the appellants had the authority to remove the products from Minnesota. When they remove those products from Minnesota, you are conceding that the district court did not have the authority to order those products back into the state in order for the board to embargo them.
Yes, we would concede that if they had that authority to remove them. But that's the issue here. They did not have that authority to remove them for several reasons. First of all, these products were directly at issue in the litigation. The respondents had authority to embargo them and to petition the district court to have them condemned and destroyed. Respondents did so. They petitioned the district court to have all of these.
Hold on a second. Again, you're not challenging, the state's not challenging the district court's order in defining those products that were removed as, quote, unembargoed, meaning they were not embargoed properly. The fact that you're conceding that, I think, makes your argument now troublesome.
And perhaps I'm not speaking as clearly as I should. We're not conceding that the court had authority to hold these an injunction in order to provide the board and respondents, the department, sufficient time to go back out and stick the additional embargo stickers that were necessary to provide the notice. That's what the court ordered when it issued the May 24th order. So what happened is that after petitioning the district court to have all 511 boxes of the product that everyone knew was at issue in the litigation condemned and destroyed, respondents found out that appellants had been secretly sneaking into the facility at night, swapping out non-compliant products, replacing them with other products, and sealing the boxes back up to conceal that misconduct. Now, when respondents did that, they knew these boxes were at issue in the litigation. They knew that respondents had embargoed or at least attempted to embargo them. They were in the process of being condemned and destroyed per the district court's statutory authority to determine whether they should be condemned and destroyed. The whole reason that respondents went in and tried to conceal their conduct is because these products were at issue in the litigation. The district court had authority to oversee those products and maintain them in safekeeping.
You keep referring to at issue in the litigation, but I don't see any language in the statute that gives the board any authority over products that are at issue. I think the board has authority over products that are embargoed. And you use the term the board either embargoed or attempted to embargo. But I think you've conceded already, because it's not at issue on appeal, that those products that were not properly embargoed were unembargoed. They weren't embargoed.
Yes,
whether the board attempted to or not seems to me not relevant, perhaps relevant to the district court's TRO. But if the TRO expired, that's the universe I'm trying to get.
Yes. And I agree with your honor. I think the universe here is whether or not that product removal prohibition had expired, because the whole point of prohibiting them from removing anything was so the court could determine what we need to do to put notice on everything to show what all was embargoed.
Just to put a fine point on it then, sure. You're conceding that if in fact that TRO expired as a matter of law, then appellant should prevail in this appeal.
Oh, no, I do not agree with that at all. I think if that had expired, appellants would still prevented from removing it because it was unlawful to possess anyway under Section 152. Because these products were non-compliant, they were unlawful.
I saw that in your brief, but I didn't see any authority. I saw you cite to the fact that it was unlawful. I didn't see anything in your brief that would support your proposition that therefore they can't touch the products. They're not allowed to remove them if they were in fact now illegal. So what's the basis for that?
Minnesota statute section 152, chapter 152, prohibits any person from possessing, transporting, handling Schedule I controlled substances. These non-compliant THC edibles were Schedule I controlled substances. So even if appellants had authority to do everything they did, they still could not possess and transport these products because they were Schedule I controlled substances. And I'd like to continue to answer questions, but I'm ready to move on to the expiration date, because I think that's really the crux of the appeal, revolves around this product removal prohibition. The district court had ordered appellants not to remove any products whatsoever from the facility until it could rule on the issue of the statutory interpretation. When it ruled on that, it gave respondents additional time to go out there and mark everything to show what they were embargoing. The district court had made clear from the very get-go, this is what it was doing. It was going to rule on the issue. It was going to give respondents time to comply if necessary. And then it was going to allow appellants to begin removing all these other products out of the facility. The whole purpose here was to ensure that everyone understood what was under embargo and what could then be removed. What happened, however, is appellants misinterpreted that expiration date. When respondents received the order clearly intended this midnight expiration date to mean the end of the day on May 25th.
You say that in your brief. You say it clearly intended. Now, I read the transcript. The district court said, after the fact, the court intended for this to be the date. Before the court said that, what was the, quote, clear indication that that's what the court meant? What was the, what supports that proposition?
Yes, thank you for that question. It was the very next clause in the order that says to provide respondents sufficient time to comply with the ruling. That language showed that it meant to provide respondents with sufficient time to comply with the ruling. Respondents would not have physically been able to comply with the ruling if the court had meant midnight to mean the beginning of the day as opposed to the end of the day as it intended, because respondents are 4 hours away from Moorhead. They had to make all the arrangements necessary to get out there. They had to gather a bunch of new stickers. There is no way they would have been able, even if they were able to leave at 1:45 when the order dropped, they wouldn't have even been able to make it there before the close of the business day on May 24th. It took to the end of the business day just to make the arrangements necessary to get there by noon the next day. So from our reading, it clearly intended it to mean the next day, the end of the day. Now, when the court acknowledged it made a mistake, the court was not necessarily saying, I screwed up completely. The court was looking at it as, boy, midnight was perhaps an ambiguous term. I should have used a more clear term to show exactly when this expired. Corrected that.
So the district court apparently didn't adopt your view that it was so clear that midnight couldn't have meant the day before the district court really intended it.
Not necessarily. The court, when it issued its written order, it said it made a finding that it clearly intended midnight to mean the end of the day. So the court did make that finding, and I agree with that. During the oral argument,
but the district court,
the transcript, they acknowledged.
The district court didn't say in its written order that it made a mistake. It did say that when it was faced with it on first blush.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the omission was significant to me. It seems like the district court didn't want to acknowledge in the written findings what the district court did acknowledge on the record, which was that the court, quote, made a mistake.
And I think that any way you look at this, the orders were proper and should be affirmed, because either the district court, as it stated in the written order, was clear that it intended this to be the end of the day and appellants misinterpreted it, or as the court stated in the oral argument, this was a mistake. I'm going to fix the mistake. And the court had authority to correct this mistake per the rules of civil procedure. So it's either way you look at it, whether you look at it the way the court described it as a mistake at the oral argument, or as the court determined.
Let's assume the court had the authority to issue a new order and say, you can't remove any products. But assume for the sake of argument that the order had expired by mistake, but it expired. The products were removed out of state. And then the district court says, no, 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 I meant this date. Why would the district court then have the authority if the products were lawfully removed based upon the expiration, whether it's ambiguous or certainly the date that appellant is suggesting? Why would the court have the authority to bring, to let the, basically direct the appellant to bring the products back within the authority of the board?
Certainly. And so using these hypotheticals and for the sake of argument, if the appellants had perfect authority and could lawfully remove this product, a district court still has had personal jurisdiction over them because they do business in Clay County. And the product was at issue. The court obtained jurisdiction to determine how to keep this product in safekeeping. The court did so by ordering appellants first not to tamper with the board's embargo after they had been tampering with it, and then secondly, to not remove anything at all from the facility until it could determine whether or not respondents needed to go back out there and stick additional stickers on these other boxes. Now, another thing I'd like to point out here.
Your time has expired. I was just checking to see if any of your panel members had additional questions they'd like to have you cover. I see none. So thank you. We'll accept your briefing for the rest of your points. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Andrew Cook again on behalf of Northland. I'd like to circle back to Judge Ross's questions about the authority to bring back products into the state. The board argued that the products were at issue in the proceedings. I think that ignores the court's order that the products were not embargoed. Since they were not embargoed, it follows that they were not at issue in the proceeding from the start. I would also note there was a reference to Northland secretly swapping out boxes. Those boxes were not embargoed. And that, again, just highlights the importance of why this embargo statute exists and why it was clear to why it was important to make clear what was embargoed and what was not embargoed to avoid disputes like that. The board also argued that it would still not be permissible to remove the products because they're unlawful. Again, that ignores the court's order that expired the restriction on removing products. The court itself was contemplating that these products could be removed when it expired that restriction, and that order hasn't been appealed. There was arguments on...
I'd like to ask about that with the potential unlawful nature. If it is illegal to possess these products in Minnesota, is that a problem that then your client, I mean, is that a concession that they at one point were in possession of illicit drugs?
I think the problem is they're referring to criminal statutes and we're dealing with a civil case. We're dealing with an embargo case, and my position in Northland's position all along has been that we need to follow the embargo statute because that's what commenced this civil proceeding.
Well, they're citing the pharmacy statute, not the criminal possession statute. They're citing the pharmaceutical restrictions, and those restrictions include criminal provisions, but they are within the same purview of the Board of Pharmacy.
Correct. At the time this case was commenced, the laws changed. But I think the issue, though, is the enforcement provision within that statute refers back to the embargo statute. So we get back to the same place because it says you enforce that through the embargo. And that's why we're arguing about the embargo. But
to the fine point, though, if the statute prohibits your client from transporting Schedule I drugs, then why wouldn't the court have authority more generally, not for the sake of embargo, but just generally speaking, you can't transport those products. I'm ordering you to bring them back to the state. Why doesn't the court have that authority under that related arm?
Well, that's not what the court did. The court said that the restriction on removal was expiring. The products were removed out of state. And then it becomes the jurisdictional problem that I think you highlighted through your questions earlier about bringing back into the state products that are no longer here. And that opens up questions of whether the board has that authority to regulate products in that fashion. So I don't necessarily think we have to answer that question about whether the court could hypothetically go down that road, because I think we have to look at what the court actually ordered. with expiring that removal prohibition, with finding the embargo insufficient. Couple final points. There was arguments about sufficient time to embargo. That doesn't change the midnight at May 25th language. That's a singular time. And I think the broader point, these are equitable arguments on how much time the board have had to embargo. I just want to make clear, the board knew about this issue for months. We raised this issue in March about statutory interpretation. The court previously told the board the restriction on removal would expire once it ruled on that question. So the board was well aware that this could happen, and it even had access to the facility on March 30th during the time, and it chose not to reinstitute another embargo.
Is there any evidence in the record that your client was aware of the time that it would take for the board members to the agents to arrive at the facility?
There's nothing on the sufficient time, because that was something that the court created on its own. It inserted that when it ruled on that statutory interpretation question. So it's not as if the board had requested X amount of hours to allow it sufficient time. That was just something the court inserted on its own when it came up with that order. I think the fundamental question I want to close on is, I don't think the court is allowed to give the government a redo after it failed to follow the law the first time. The legislature sets the policy. It did that through the embargo statute. The court's role is to interpret the statute. It did that by finding the embargo was not sufficient. And at that point, I don't think the government gets another bite at the apple. So we ask for a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Cook. Well argued, well briefed. Been on the court for quite a while. I have never until today had a gummy bear case, never had to use the term gummy bear in an opinion. And I'm sure neither of my colleagues did, but that's what we're going to do at some point. We appreciate your briefing. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the last case on our oral calendar for today. So the court is therefore in recess. Thank you.